This is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moscowane. Poet Charles Simic was born in what used to be Yugoslavia. He grew up in Belgrade during World War II before emigrating with his family to the United States in the 1950s. Simic is the editor and translator of a new anthology of Serbian poetry called The Horse Has Six Legs. It features works by 18 contemporary poets. Influenced by surrealism and mythology, Serbian poetry has a haunting and tragic richness that reflects the region's history of invasions, conquest, and civil strife. Simic has written many of his own books of poetry, most recently The Book of God and Devils and The World Doesn't End, for which he received a Pulitzer Prize in 1990. Among the poets featured in this anthology is Desanka Maksimovic, who at the age of 94 is still writing. She is one of the most popular and widely read of the Serbian poets. I asked Charles Simic to read one of her poems called Bloody Fable.
Bloody Fable describes an event that occurred in a town called Kragujevac, which is in Serbia in 1941, or was it? I think it's 1941. Since the Germans had a rule for every killed German, they would take 100 hostages and execute them. 10,000 people were killed by the Germans. The Germans came in and sort of counted 10,000 and took, you know, as she describes, took kids out of school and then they, you know, they counted till 10,000, and if they had extra people, they sent them home. But it was 10,000. You know, it's like very precise, you know. So anyway, this is the this is one of her very famous poems, Bloody Fable. It happened in some peasant land in the hilly Balkans. A troop of schoolboys died a martyr's death in a single day. All were born in the same year, and their school days were identical. Together they were taken to the same celebrations. Together they were inoculated against the same illness, and they all died in the same way. It happened in some peasant land in the hilly Balkans. A troop of schoolboys died a martyr's death in a single day. 50 minutes before the moment of their death, they still sat in their seats, that troop of schoolboys solving the same difficult problem. How far can a traveler traveling on foot, and so forth? Their heads were full of the same numbers, and their bags full of notebooks with good and bad grades. The same dreams, the same secrets, patriotic and romantic, lay pressed in their pockets. To all of them, it seemed that long, they'll run under the blue sky until all the quizzes in the world are solved. It happened in some peasant land in the hilly Balkans. A troop of schoolboys died a martyr's death in a single day. Whole rows of boys took each other by the hand and from the last class calmly walked before the fighting squad as if death were nothing. Whole rows of friends rose at the same time to their eternal abode.
There's a quote I want to read that, from an interview in the American Poetry Review where you say poetry is a place where all the fundamental questions are asked about the human condition. And when I read that, I thought about this poetry that you've been translating and even your own and then what is going on in Bosnia today.
Well, there's a kind of a, you know, I think my poetry and their poetry, I mean, there's a deep pessimism, historical pessimism, you know. I mean, you know, I still can't get over the last war, the big war, you know, and here's another set of horrors, you know. And I don't think one comes to an understanding. I mean, you don't, you know, you don't say, well, they died because of such and such, you know. No, you know, you never do. I mean, I think you're just left with despair, you know.
You've said that you don't feel Yugoslavian. You came to this country when you were 11 years old. And I'm wondering...
No, actually, I was 15. I was 15.
I'm sorry, when you were 15.
Yeah.
I wonder, though, with the fighting that's going on there, whether you feel a pull back to your country where you were born.
Not to, certainly to go back. I mean, I feel a sense of tragedy. I mean, I feel awful to watch it. There was I was watching CNN the other day, and there was a a woman, she's running down this road, and she is holding one child, a small child, and another little kid about 5 years old is running by her side, and these reporters who are not seeing, they're sticking these mics in their face, and this, and she's saying in Serbian, she's saying, I don't understand. I don't understand what you're saying. Leave me alone. Leave me alone, you know, and they're sort of jabbering away. I mean, they're, you know, this just, you don't even see the reporters. You see these hands, you know, and this frightened woman who is going someplace wants to be left alone. Well, it reminds me of my childhood. You know, my mother used to run like this with my brother in her arms, and I wasn't by her side. And awful. I mean, awful. I mean, I couldn't sleep, you know, after seeing this poor woman. And it's nothing excuses it. I mean, just endless, you know, the suffering of these poor people. And my childhood is coming back to me.
You were born in the late 30s and survived the bombing of Belgrade during the Second World War. What memories do you have of that time, that early time in your life?
Well, my first memory, where my sort of memory life starts, is when the Germans bombed Belgrade, 1941, 6th of April. I was 3 years old, and I don't remember very clearly, but I remember enough. What happened is that the bomb hit a building across the street from where we lived. We lived sort of in downtown Belgrade, and I flew out of my crib across the room, and I sort of remember the room being all lit up, you know. And so that's sort of my life. Memory starts with a bomb, you know, across the street. And then what happened later on, of course, is that the Allies used to bomb Belgrade because to bomb Germans there. The Allies, English and American, who were in Italy then, flew to Romania, where the oil fields were being attacked, bombed, because this was the last... this is the last place that the Nazis had oil, you know. So they would go there and bomb the Romanian oil fields, and on the way back they would unload over Belgrade. And so that started in, I believe, in 1944, and in Easter. So there was that bombing, you know. And then of course then the Russians came, and you know, so there was a lot of violence in the city, and. What can I tell you? I mean, it was a very rich childhood.
Very rich childhood, meaning it was full of every emotion.
Well, you know, when you're a kid, a city kid, in the middle of the city during wartime, I know this sounds ridiculous, but, you know, you have bad memories, but you also have how shall I say? I mean, it was a time when you could run around. You know, the parents are busy. My father was in Italy during the war, and my mother was trying to make ends meet. And the rest of us kids, we were just sort of running around, you know, loose. You know, as far as I was concerned, I didn't know any better. I mean, it isn't that I. You know, at the age of six or at the end of the war or whatever, I was 7 years old, that I thought about things. I mean, I didn't sit down and say, isn't this awful? No, you know, I just sort of ran around, and like all the other kids, you know, who were kind of semi-abandoned. And we thought we were having a terrific time.
Well, I'd love to have you read a poem you wrote, and this is from a book of yours called The Book of Gods and Devils. And the book is called The Big War.
Right. This is a poem from that period. I mean, I was very young here, obviously, but I think the poem really tells everything. The Big War. We played war during the war, Margaret. Toy soldiers were in big demand, the kind made from clay. The lead ones, they melted into bullets, I suppose. You never saw anything as beautiful as those clay regiments. I used to lie on the floor for hours staring them in the eye. I remember them staring back at me in wonder. How strange they must have felt standing stiffly at attention before a large, incomprehending creature with a mustache made of milk. In time, they broke, or I broke them on purpose. There was wire inside their limbs, inside their chests, but nothing in the heads. Margaret, I made sure, nothing at all in the heads. Just an arm, now and then, an officer's arm wielding a saber from a crack in my deaf grandmother's kitchen floor.
My guest is poet Charles Simic. He was born in the late 30s in Yugoslavia and emigrated with his family to the United States when he was 15. He lives in New Hampshire now, where he teaches at the University of New Hampshire. He won a Pulitzer Prize in 1990 for his book of poems called The World Doesn't End. That was followed in 1991 by The Book of Gods and Devils. Most recently, he's edited and translated an anthology of Serbian poetry called The Horse Has Six Legs. We'll pick up on our conversation after a short break. This is Fresh Air. My guest on Fresh Air today is poet Charles Simic. You've said that Hitler and Stalin were your travel agents. How difficult was it for you and your family to leave Yugoslavia after the war?
I'll tell you, we loved leaving Yugoslavia. I mean, it was, my father was already in the United States, so we were very happy to leave. We tried to sneak out in 1940, I think it was 1946. We crossed into Austria illegally at night, my mother and my brother and I. And we're eventually, two, 3 days later, returned by the English. The English used to return escapees. You know, they sent a lot of Russians back from who were in camps during the war, you know, and that was the sort of the English thing, you know. And anyways, we ended up in jail because we were enemies of the state.
How long were you in jail?
We were in jail. My mother was a few months. I was only 2 weeks because I was, I was 8 years old, right?
You were 8 years old in jail?
Yeah.
What was jail like?
Well, jail, you know, it was, what an adventure. I mean, it was an incredible adventure. I remember, because it kept moving us. You know, we were delivered at the border, which is the border of Austria. So we went from jail to jail to jail to eventually, you know, arrive in Belgrade. So we were in many, many prisons. And I remember coming into this prison in Belgrade. It was, by the time they sort of separated us, this is the first time they separated my mother and me, and they took me to be with men. It was about 2, 3 o'clock in the morning, and, you know, when somebody comes into cells 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning, everybody's very nervous. Usually people don't sleep around that hour because this is the time when you're taken out for interrogation or the other thing. So instead of, you know, somebody being dragged out to be shot, you know, they deliver me, and I still remember this, a packed cell. I mean, a lot of them, because it was dark, so you couldn't see, you know. And one old man saying to me, he says, you know, what are you doing here, poor child, you know? And so I think that's where I started being a writer. I started inventing even further adventures. I explained to them, I told them what happened to us, but of course I elaborated, I made it bigger than it was, and
Did someone take you under his wing?
Well, they did. I mean, they made room for me, and it was fairly squeezed. They gave me blankets and this and that, and I remember the bed bugs. I mean, it was just really. I mean, your face would be instantly covered, you know, with bed bugs, and. I didn't stay there very long in that particular, so we kept moving.
Let me ask you about coming to this country. You came at the age of 15, mm-hmm. which is, of course, an awkward time for any person, being in a new place, learning a new language. How did you learn to feel at home in the United States? And you've said you really do feel like you feel at home here.
Well, I do feel at home because once I, you know, went back to Yugoslavia and I traveled a couple of times back, and I realized that I was really very different. I mean, that there was a separation that I... that I kind of had spent too many years over here, that I had too many experiences in this country. Coming here was, well, it was difficult. You know, it's always difficult to be a new kid in school with an accent. My father loved this country, always had. I mean, he had a kind of a romance with America. When he was a young man in Belgrade in 1922, I think, he had a scholarship to Columbia University in New York. He never went, you know, then, because his friends told him, you know, why do you want to go so far? You know, stay here, you know. But he sort of regretted that for the rest of his life. And he kind of greeted us with this great enthusiasm that he had for this country. I can't say that, you know, the thing about it, in those days, you know, because there was all communism over there in Eastern Europe, nobody had any intention of ever returning. So you knew that you had to make a life here.
So you didn't look back?
I didn't look back at all.
I know that you served in the U.S. Army in the mm-hmm. in the early 60s, and you said it really influenced you as a poet because it gave you a humbler view of yourself. Did you need to be humble?
Well, I think, you know, there's nothing like basic training, you know, to bring it down to earth. Well, Army is an astonishing experience. I mean, you realize that, you know, I mean, you realize certain things about the world. You know, I was a draftee. I was surprised to be drafted. There was some kind of a crisis. I think it was one of the Berlin crises or whatever when I was drafted. And being in the army for a while, you know, I mean, there's something about being a literary person, you know, living a kind of, quote unquote, intellectual life in Chicago or New York. You lose touch with certain kind of realities of life. And after being in the army for about 6 months, I finally had my brother send me the poems that I had been writing for years before that. And they arrived one night as I was sitting in the barracks. Everybody else was shining shoes. And I started looking at these poems that I wrote, you know, poems influenced by every major American poet previous to, you know, this you know, period. I mean, you know, influences of Ezra Pound and Stevens and, you know, Hart Crane and everybody, you know. And as I read these poems, you know, they struck me as derivative, as silly, as foolish. I mean, I suddenly saw things very clearly. I threw everything out I had written.
You threw everything out?
I threw everything out without any drama, without any great regret. I just struck by how inferior they were, you know. And I always felt that the reality of this barracks, you know, surrounded by people shining shoes, listening to country music, you know, radios blaring different stations, you know, and people playing cards. I mean, my poetry just didn't pass the test, you know.
Well, let me ask you something, because you talked about learning to write when you were young and learning to embellish on the adventures and you mm-hmm. were having, and yet you seem, as a poet, to use so few words. It's really an economy of words, and it looks almost as if your poems are a paring down process, a whittling down process.
Yes.
To finding that precise word.
Yes, I mean, I always have been obsessed in poetry with sort of minimum. In poetry, I mean, you can embellish too in poetry, but I have mostly tried to write poems that are almost plain, very short, very precise, and without perhaps these, you know, this kind of embellishments.
Well, I'd love to actually finish out this conversation with a poem that you wrote in your latest book of poems called The Book of Gods and Devils, and this poem is called Paradise.
Well, this is a poem about New York. I mean, yeah. There are a number of poems about New York City in this book, and this is a poem. The events in the poem occur in, I think, 1959. Paradise. In a neighborhood once called Hell's Kitchen, where a beggar claimed to be playing Nero's fiddle while the city burned in midsummer heat, where a lady barber who called herself Cleopatra wielded the scissors of fate over my head, threatening to cut off my ears and nose, where a man and a woman went walking naked in one of the dark side streets at dawn. I must be dreaming, I told myself. It was like meeting a couple of sphinxes. I expected them to have wings, bodies of lions, him with his widely tattooed chest, her with her huge dangling breasts. It happened so quickly and so long ago. You know that time just before the day breaks, when one yearns to lie down on cool sheets in a room with shades drawn. The hour when the beautiful suicides lying side by side in the morgue get up and walk out into the first light. The curtains of cheap hotels flying out of windows like seagulls, but everything else quiet. Steam rising out of the subway gratings. Bodies glistening with sweat. Madness, and you might even say, paradise.
I really love that poem. And I know that you spent some time living in New York City.
12 years.
And you were a young man from 58 to 61, something like that.
No, I lived in New York from 1958 to 1970, except for the Army, for the 2 years in the Army.
And the sort of madness and wonderfulness of the city. I mean, that seemed to captivate you so much.
Yes. I mean, I wanted to capture that element, I mean, of beauty, ugliness, everything together, you know, just this great mixture of moments which are terrifying and exhilarating at the same time. And I love New York City. I mean, I think the poem is a kind of one, not just this poem, but the whole book is a kind of an ode, homage to the city.
Well, I want to thank you very much, Charles Simic, for joining us today on Fresh Air. It was a real pleasure to talk with you.
Thank you.
Charles Simic is the editor and translator of a book of Serbian poetry called The Horse Has Six Legs, published by Grey Wolf Press. His most recent collection of poems is The Book of Gods and Devils. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, and this is Fresh Air.